Listening Library presents Unbroken, an Olympian's journey from airman to castaway to captive. The Young Adult Adaptation by Laura Hillenbrand. Read for you by Edward Herman. For the Wounded and the Lost. Introduction. All he could see in every direction was water. It was June 22, 1943. Somewhere on the Pacific Ocean, American military airman and Olympic runner Louis Zamperini lay on a small raft, drifting. Slumped beside him was another crewman. On another raft, tethered to the first, lay the pilot, a gash zigzagging across his forehead. Their bodies, sunburned and stained yellow from the dye of the rafts, had shrunken to skeletons. Sharks glided in lazy loops around them, dragging their backs along the rafts, waiting. The Second World War was raging, and in the Pacific, America and Japan were locked in a bloody struggle. Zamperini and his crew had been searching for a lost warplane when their bomber had crashed into the ocean. They'd been adrift for 27 days and had floated at least 1,000 miles. The rafts were turning to jelly. The men's bodies were pocked with salt sores, their burned lips so swollen they pressed into their nostrils and chins. They spent their days watching the sky, singing White Christmas. They were alone on 64 million square miles of ocean. A month earlier, 26-year-old Zamperini had been one of the greatest runners in the world. Now his body had wasted to less than 100 pounds, and his famous legs could not lift him. Almost everyone, outside of his family, had given him up for dead. On that 27th day, the men heard a distant, deep strumming. Their eyes caught a glint in the sky, a plane high overhead. Zamperini fired two flares and shook powdered dye into the water, enveloping the rafts in a circle of vivid orange. The plane kept going, slowly disappearing. The men sagged. Then the plane reappeared. The crew had seen them. Overjoyed, the castaways shouted, waving arms, starved to little more than bone and skin. The plane dropped low and swept alongside the rafts. Zamperini saw the crewmen's profiles dark against bright blueness. Suddenly, there was a terrific roar, and the ocean seemed to boil. It was machine gun fire. This wasn't an American rescue plane. It was a Japanese bomber. The men pitched themselves into the sea and hung under the rafts, cringing as bullets pierced the rubber and sliced lines in the water around their faces. The firing blazed on, then spluttered out as the bomber overshot them. The men dragged themselves onto the one raft that was still mostly inflated. The bomber circled toward them again, the machine guns taking aim. Zamperini's crewmates were too weak to go back into the water. As they lay down, hands over their heads, Zamperini splashed overboard alone. Somewhere below, the sharks were done waiting. They bent their bodies in the water and swam toward the man under the raft. Part 1. Chapter 1. The One Boy Insurgency. In the pre-dawn darkness of August 26, 1929, in a small house in Torrance, California, a 12-year-old boy sat up in bed, listening. There was a huge, heavy rushing sound, growing ever louder, coming from directly above the house. The boy swung his legs off his bed, raced out the back door, and loped onto the grass. The yard was otherworldly, shivering with sound. The boy stood beside his brother, head thrown back, spellbound. The sky had disappeared. An object he saw only in silhouette reaching across a massive arc of space, was suspended low over the house. It was longer than 2.5 football fields and as tall as a city. It was putting out the stars. It was the German airship Graf Zeppelin. Nearly 800 feet long and 110 feet high, it was the largest flying machine ever crafted. It was the wonder of the world. The airship was 3 days from completing a sensational feat, a journey around the globe. It had begun on August 7th, when the Zeppelin had slipped its tethers in New Jersey and headed for Manhattan. On Fifth Avenue that summer, construction was soon to begin on a new skyscraper, the Empire State Building. At Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, Babe Ruth prepared to hit his 500th home run. On Wall Street, stocks raced toward an all-time high. After a lap around the Statue of Liberty, the Zeppelin banked north, then turned over the Atlantic. In time, it reached Europe. The ship passed over Nuremberg, Germany, where an obscure politician named Adolf Hitler had just called for the killing of the weakest babies to strengthen the German race. Then it flew east to Frankfurt, where a Jewish woman was nursing her newborn, Anne Frank. Sailing northeast, the Zeppelin crossed over Siberia, where villagers, so isolated they'd never even seen a train, fell to their knees at the sight of it. On August 19th, as 4 million Japanese waved handkerchiefs, the Zeppelin circled Tokyo and sank onto a landing field. 4 days later, the ship rose into a typhoon that whisked it over the Pacific toward America. Passengers gazing from the windows saw the ship's shadow following it on the clouds, like a huge shark. When the clouds parted, they glimpsed giant creatures turning in the sea that looked like monsters. On August 25th, the Zeppelin reached San Francisco, where crowds thronged the streets to see it. Turning south, it slid through sunset, across midnight, and over Torrance, where the boy in his pajamas stood. Under the airship, his feet bare in the grass, he was transfixed. In the dark, he felt the rumble of the craft's engines, but couldn't see the ship itself. He saw only blackness, so vast it seemed to swallow heaven itself. The boy's name was Louis Zamperini. The son of Italian immigrants, he'd come into the world in Olean, New York, on January 26, 1917, an 11.5-pound baby with black hair as coarse as barbed wire. From the moment he could walk, Louis couldn't be corralled. The instant his mother thumped him down and told him to be still, he vanished. If she didn't have her squirming boy clutched in her hands, she usually had no idea where he was. In 1919, when 2-year-old Louis was sick with pneumonia, he climbed out his bedroom window, descended one story, and went on a naked dash through town, with a policeman chasing him and a crowd watching in amazement. Soon after, during the family's move to California, Louis bolted, ran through the train, and leapt from the caboose. Frantic as the train rolled backward in search of her lost boy, Louis's mother spotted him strolling in perfect serenity. Swept into her arms, Louis smiled. "I knew you'd come back," he said in Italian. In California, the family settled in the Los Angeles suburb of Torrance. Louis was as wild as ever. At 5, he started smoking, picking up cigarette butts while walking to kindergarten. He began drinking one night when he was 8. He hid under the dinner table, snatched glasses of wine, drank them all dry, staggered right off the front porch, and fell into a rose bush. Leaping around one day, he impaled his leg on a bedpost. On another day, a neighbor had to sew his nearly severed toe back on. When Louis came home drenched in oil after diving into an oil rig well and nearly drowning, it took a gallon of turpentine and a lot of scrubbing before his father recognized him again. Thrilled by the crashing of boundaries, Louis was untamable. In Torrance, a rebel was born. If it was edible, Louis stole it. Housewives who stepped from their kitchens returned to find their suppers gone. Residents looking out their windows saw a long-legged boy dashing by, a stolen cake balanced on his hands. He broke into his neighbor's house, bribed their Great Dane with a bone, and cleaned out their icebox. He picked the lock at the town bakery, snatched pies, ate until he was full, and used the rest as ammunition for ambushes. Years later, when Louis told of his youth, most of his stories ended with, "Then I ran like mad." People he robbed often chased him, and some threatened to shoot him. To minimize the evidence found on him when the police habitually came his way, he set up loot-stashing sites, including a cave he dug in the forest. Louis's older brother Pete once found one of his stolen wine jugs under the Torrance High bleachers. It was teeming with drunken ants. In the Torrance Theater lobby, Louis crammed the payphone coin slots with toilet paper, then returned later to feed wire behind the coins stacked up inside, hook the paper, and fill his palms with change. A metal dealer never guessed that the grinning kid who often came by to sell him copper scrap had stolen the same scrap from his lot the night before. Discovering while scuffling with an enemy that adults would give quarters to fighting kids to pacify them, Louis declared a truce with the enemy and cruised around, staging brawls. When a teacher stood Louis in a corner for spitballing, he deflated her car tires. He set a Boy Scout state record in friction fire ignition by mixing his tinder with gasoline and match heads, causing a small explosion. He stole a neighbor's coffee percolator tube, set up a sniper's nest in a tree, spat pepper tree berries through the tube, and sent girls running. His greatest feat became legend. Late one night, Louis climbed a church steeple, tied piano wire to the bell, strung the wire into a nearby tree, and roused the police, firefighters, and all of Torrance with apparently spontaneous pealing. Some townsfolk called it a miracle. During a raucous childhood, Louis made more than just mischief. He shaped who he'd become. Confident that he was clever and bold enough to escape anything, he was almost incapable of discouragement. When history carried him into war, this resilient optimism would define him. Louis was 2 years younger than his brother, who was everything he wasn't. Pete Zamperini was handsome, popular, and silky smooth with girls. He ushered his mother into her seat at dinner, went to bed at 7, and rose at 2:30 to run a 3-hour paper route, tucking his alarm clock under his pillow so it wouldn't wake Louis, who shared a bed with him. He had a gallant habit of carrying pins in his pant cuffs in case his dance partner's dress strap broke. He once saved a drowning girl. Pete radiated a gentle authority that led everyone, even adults, to be swayed by his opinion. Louis idolized Pete, who watched over him and their younger sisters, Sylvia and Virginia, with a parent's protectiveness. But he was overshadowed, and he never heard the end of it, even from his mother, who wept as she asked Louis why he couldn't be like Pete. Louis didn't fit in with other kids. He was a puny boy, and thanks to the lingering effects of his pneumonia, in picnic foot races, every girl in town could dust him. His earlobes leaned off his head like holstered pistols, and above them waved the riotous hair that mortified him. He tried to smooth it with his Aunt Margie's hot iron, hobbled it in a stocking every night, and slathered it in so much olive oil that flies trailed him around. It did no good. Then there was his ethnicity. In Torrance in the 1920s, there was so much prejudice against Italians that when the Zamperinis arrived, the neighbors petitioned the city council to keep them out. Louis, who knew little English until grade school, couldn't hide his heritage. He survived kindergarten by keeping quiet. But in first grade, when he blurted out an Italian insult at another kid, his teachers caught on. They deepened his misery by holding him back a grade. He was a marked boy. Bullies pummeled him with rocks, taunted him, punched him, and kicked him. He could have run away, but he refused to bend. "You could beat him to death," said Sylvia, "and he wouldn't say ouch or cry. He just put his hands in front of his face and took it." As Louis neared his teens, he took a hard turn. He pretended to be tough, but was secretly tormented. Frustrated by his inability to defend himself, he made a study of it. His father taught him how to punch and made him a barbell from lead-filled coffee cans welded to a pipe. The next time a bully came at Louis, he ducked left and swung his right fist straight into the boy's mouth. The bully shrieked, his tooth broken, and fled. On his walk home, Louis felt light as air. Louis's temper grew shorter, his skills sharper. He socked a girl. He pushed a teacher. He pelted a policeman with rotten tomatoes. Kids who crossed him wound up with fat lips, and bullies learned to give him a wide berth. Louis's father, Anthony, was at wit's end, but his forceful spankings did no good. Louis's mother, Louise, took a different tack. Louis was a copy of her, right down to the vivid blue eyes. She loved mischief and understood Louis's restiveness, and when pushed, she shoved. One Halloween, she dressed as a boy and raced around town with Louis and Pete. A gang of kids, thinking she was one of the local toughs, tackled her and tried to steal her pants. Little Louise Zamperini, mother of four, was deep in the melee when the cops picked her up for brawling. Knowing that punishing Louis would only arouse his defiance, Louise tried bribing a soft boy named Hugh, giving him pie in exchange for information on Louis. Louise suddenly knew everything Louis was up to, and her children thought she was psychic. Sure that Sylvia was snitching, Louis chased her around the block and into their father's shed. When Louis flushed her out by feeding his pet snake into the crawl space, Sylvia locked herself in the car and didn't come out until nightfall. For all her efforts, Louise couldn't tame Louis. He ran away and wandered for days, sleeping under a highway overpass. Eventually, he limped home with a gashed knee, having tried to ride a steer in a pasture and gotten tossed into a tree. 27 stitches didn't reform him. He punched a kid so hard he broke his nose. He upended another boy and stuffed paper towels in his mouth. Parents forbade their kids to go near him. A farmer, furious over Louis's robberies, loaded his shotgun with rock salt and blasted him in the tail. Louis beat one boy so badly, leaving him unconscious in a ditch, that he was afraid he'd killed him. When Louise saw the blood on Louis's fists, she burst into tears. As Louis entered Torrance High, he was looking less like a mischievous kid and more like a dangerous young man. High school would surely be the end of his education. There was no money for college. Anthony's paycheck always ran out before week's end, forcing Louise to improvise meals with eggplant, milk, stale bread, and rabbits Louis and Pete shot. Louis's job prospects were poor. The Depression had come, and nearly a quarter of Americans were unemployed. Louis had no ambitions. If asked what he wanted to do with his life, he would have said, "Be a cowboy." In the 1930s, a fake science known as eugenics was gathering a mass following. By preventing unfit people from having children, eugenicists believed the human race would be strengthened. Along with the feeble-minded, insane, and criminal, the unfit included orphans, the disabled, and the poor. Some eugenicists advocated killing undesirables, and in mental hospitals, scores of patients were quietly done away with. At one mental hospital, patients were given milk from cows infected with tuberculosis, in the belief that the unfit would perish. Some 40% of patients died. A more popular tool of eugenics was forced sterilization.